It's another day on this incredible planet on which we live. Let's talk about the positive impacts people are making as I present part two of my Earth Day celebration on the Wine Road.
It's really about kind of cultivating all the relationships between all the different species, the plant species, the insect species, the bird species. You kind of have to think of it as a continuum of species that you're cultivating on your property.
With that sense of place should come that environmental and ecological balance so that whatever you need to do in the vineyard is as little as possible, right? You're not spraying insecticides. You've got a natural rhythm. The vines have a natural health.
This podcast is being posted on Sunday, April 21st, one day before Earth Day 2019. Sustainability is key to preserving our planet for generations to come. Much like the slow food movement, Italy's slow wine crusade is all about sustainable farming and winemaking practices, and the Slow Wine Guide features those who operate within those parameters. As I mentioned last week, the slow food movement began in Italy in the mid-1980s, and it was no coincidence that it arose after the opening of the first two McDonald's fast food restaurants there. Slow Wine kicked off a tour in the U.S. and San Francisco in March, which gave me a chance to learn more about the movement. I also picked up the current guide, which features 370 Italian wineries, 121 California wines, the state was added just a few years ago, and new this year, 50 Oregon wineries. You can see who they are at slowwineusa.com. If you know Italian, you can visit slowwine.it. So today I'm featuring two Northern California wineries who have been selected by Slow Wine, Lark Mead Estate Winery in Calistoga, Napa Valley, and Literai Wines of Sebastopol, Sonoma County. They're both highly respected in the industry. I'll start today at Lark Mead Family Estate. Its history goes back to the mid-1880s with the spirited Lily Hitchcock, a woman who had quite a reputation. You can read about her shenanigans on their website. Currently, the estate is owned by Cam Baker and Kate Solari Baker. The Solari family has owned the estate since 1948. Their daughter, Ann Baker, holds a master's in landscape architecture and has been shaping the property with her talents since the late 1990s. Her efforts are the focus of my first interview. And I was surprised that their very busy winemaker, Dan Petroski, who I met at the Slow Wine event, was available to join us. I'll start off with Ann.
The one thing I like about Lark Mead, especially as I'm walking around and on the website, is the artwork from your mother.
Yeah.
She does some really wonderful mixed media and paintings inspired by the land here.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, in a sense, you are an artist too, because you are bringing a grander design here. And this is certainly artistic work you're doing with the landscape.
Right. Well, no, we definitely influence each other. Like, one of my inspirations for the garden here is some of her really amazing pastels. Like, there's one of grasses that's in the house across the street that has all this light in it and all these different colors and textures, and so that was something that I wanted to bring into the winery, and it's immediately part of the entrance experience is just colors and movement and grasses and just a little bit of wildness, but also this kind of refinement of bringing all these kind of things together.
And your folks, when did they start actually turning this into their version of Lark Mead?
I would say probably 94. You know, I think we've always been coming here for, you know, as long as I can remember. And Dad's always participated with my grandpa on kind of more the business aspects of the wine industry. But in terms of developing the property, redeveloping it, and then renewing winemaking, that really started in 94 and it's been a kind of a steady progress since then.
Because I was curious about whether you were inspired by the property, and that's what gave you the idea to pursue landscape architecture.
I think partly. I mean, I was really lucky to grow up in Marin and Napa and Sonoma and spend a lot of times outdoors. Kind of just, we're just in this incredible, biodiverse, beautiful place. So I've always been inspired by being here. And we spent lots of time here in the summers and with my cousins and playing and kind of in wild country up at the foot of Mount St. Helena. So yeah, definitely. It's definitely part of my inspiration. And it's such a remarkable, fertile valley. It's magical, really, actually. It's a really special place.
I hear the word magic a lot in the wine industry. It's fun.
Yeah, it's true, though. I've traveled all over the world, you know, and if you look at, like, you know, where the Ming tombs are located in China and the descriptions of that valley, match this valley. Mm. You know, like this valley has the bones of this incredible vitality and energetics.
Yeah, it's an interesting property you have here based on what I was reading about how there's 300 feet of gravel that lies underneath the topsoil because of the ancient riverbed that ran through here. And so that provides an amazing ability for the water to drain.
Yes, we have really light, airy soils and, you know, great fertility. So we kind of have both in that soils can really breathe and water moves through them. It's a remarkable site in a lot of ways. It's like kind of a hillside vineyard on the valley floor.
And Dan, I should ask you this question. It just popped in my head. So do the roots of the vines go down beyond the topsoil into the gravel, do you think?
They do. I mean, the root systems of vines aren't as deep as we would think or believe or like them to be. But we do have root systems that are stretching and pulling from below our topsoils. And we know this through our irrigation practices and how we've learned how to cut our irrigation practice because we were wasting water. We had such drainage in our soils that we would irrigate for, you know, a couple hours and realize that, you know, after 2 or 3 hours of irrigation, we were just wasting water. There was no more available water source in the root zone at that point. So, we learned a lot about the depth of our soils and the depth of our root zone through our irrigation practices over the last 10 years.
And I imagine just that setup with the gravel below the soil gives your vines and the grapes a lot of characteristics.
Oh, we're blessed with the diversity of soil profile here that allow for an incredible textural experience in our wines. I think soil is the biggest impact on our textures of tannins and acidity and freshness. So with soils that are gravelly, that are clay-based, that are sand, silt, and loam, we are probably one of the most diverse soil profiles in the valley, which allows us to make a breadth of diverse wines. Six total wines come from the property.
Yeah, what did I read? There's 7 different soil types here on the property?
Yeah, there's easily 7 different soil types. Yeah, I don't know if you can list them all.
Well, you got through a few of them there.
Well, we have the 3 main soil types that are that based in Napa Valley are Pleasanton loam, Bale loam, and Cortina gravel, and that's that makes up over 80% of our total soil profile. And then as we get down to the point where the Napa River, Selby Creek, and Ritchie Creek all converge at the southernmost point of our property, that's when we start to see a little bit more of a diversity, a kind of a little backlog of Clear Lake soils and some more sand and silt. And I can't remember the actual physical names of those.
Volcanic rock dust everywhere, too.
I would imagine.
Yes, absolutely.
Rolling down the mountains here.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, the creeks play an important role here as well, the Napa River and the creeks.
Yes, we were kind of framed by the Napa River and Selby Creek, and both of them, I think, add a lot of biodiversity to the property and also microclimate. We get airflows through our vineyards kind of drawing up and down the creek, depending on the time of day, and certain shade patterns, which are helpful, and just brings a lot of life onto our property.
Quite a few cover crops, too, I noticed. A diverse amount of plants that you're using for your soil.
Yeah, we've been experimenting probably since around 99, using increasingly permanent no-till cover crops and more native grasses and native wildflowers. Sometimes, as part of the organic program, we use radishes and mustards and things like that that actually affect the soil health in ways we need to, but that's one of the things that we're totally striving to do is to reintroduce a lot more diversity in the cover crops and kind of try and provide that to wildlife and habitat, insectaries, and pollinators.
And I saw you've brought in a lot of pollinators, as you just mentioned. You have honeybees on the property, and you brought back more butterflies and hummingbirds, and that's really helped over the past number of years.
Yeah, I think when we first started working on the property, there really wasn't much of that, you know. There wasn't, you know, hedgerows and planted swales, and the riverbanks were largely non-native invasive plants. So it's taken us a long time, but gradually we've kind of reversed all that, and most of our surrounding landscape areas around the vineyards are native, and they're reproducing. I was out there today, and we have one black oak on the property, and today's the first day that I've seen it set its own acorns and seedlings. So, you know, you start to see things like that where you have enough of a plant where it starts to renew itself, and that's kind of what biodiversity or bioresilience would be, you know, that things actually can continue to self-sow and propagate themselves. So you have enough of them.
And what people may not think about is also fish. You've brought back salmon into the creek.
Yeah, well, we did a lot of work on Selby Creek. We joined with 13 of our neighbors around, say, 2006, and we formed what's called the Selby Creek Watershed Partners. And so 13 of our neighbors all along the valley floor from Silverado Trail down to the place where Selby Creek comes into the Napa River, and we worked on every single property and did a lot of bank and erosion control work, and we built some weir systems to control how the floods come through and kind of make sure that people aren't getting in these really silty, blown-out riverbanks. And I was just down there this morning, and it's amazing all the plants that are coming in there and all the diversity there. There really was not there in 2005 before we started. We're moving in that direction.
Well, the slow food and wine movement advocates biodiversity, so your accomplishments here is what helped the editors in the Slow Wine Guide choose Larkmead to be part of their publication.
Cool. I think it's something that people really enjoy when they come here. You know, they kind of watch the hummingbirds buzz around. You know, sometimes we find quail eggs in the potted plants on the porch. You know, you can, you know, watch a heron kind of stalk frogs and the stormwater features. You know, I think it really adds a lot of interest, and I think people are kind of yearning for that feeling of being in a healthier, natural place. You know, I think it creates a sense of well-being and delight that adds to the wine experience. You know, so it feels more holistic.
Yeah. It's certainly a delight for the eyes. I mean, it's a beautiful property. And it's funny, Kim, when she brought me out here from the tasting room, she was apologizing for the amount of birds that are singing. I'm like, that's nothing to be worried about at all.
I think
it sounds great in the background.
Right, yeah, no, the birds are amazing. And, I mean, we didn't have bluebirds, say, I don't know, 7, 8, maybe 10 years ago. We really didn't have bluebirds on the property. Now we have tons of bluebirds on the property, you know, and I think I mean, those kind of things just remind me that it's really about kind of cultivating all the relationships between all the different species, the plant species, the insect species, the bird species. You kind of have to think of it as a continuum of species that you're cultivating on your property and observing and becoming aware of what things want to live there too, you know, and how they can.
Well, congratulations on the success you've had here. Thank you. Also receiving, yeah, not a bad job. Huh?
Yeah.
Well, you received the Napa Green Land Certification and also the Napa Green Certified Winery accolade, so you're doing it right.
Yeah, and I think we want to continue. I think we learned that there's always more we can do, and we keep learning as we go along, you know, and I think we're starting to look forward into climate change challenges and how to adapt the vineyard for that and, you know, kind of get this landscape ready for that experience, and we've done so, for example, around the winery by planting lots of valley oak trees, which will probably take another 20 years to mature, but when we want them, they're going to be here.
And Dan, I imagine it also benefits you as the winemaker and also your vineyard management team here.
No, it's been wonderful. And Banana's right. We've taken our time in doing things properly here. We spent the last 20 years taking major steps towards sustainability in ways that are landmark for us, as you know, would be the Selby Creek project or becoming one of the first, you know, Napa Green wineries, and then being a Napa Land winery, then converting to organic farming. I mean, the accomplishments we've done here just to become more sustainable and more holistic and to think about the future, and especially the challenges we're going to have ahead of us as wine professionals and agriculture in California. This is, I think we've set ourselves up for an incredible opportunity ahead. And from the winemaking side, I will just have to say that it is a pure joy and pleasure to be able to work with people who are committed to the land. And, you know, the Baker family, Solari Baker family, has been so since I've been here. And it comes out in the wines. It makes my job a lot easier than it should be.
You know, we didn't mention the solar panels. I understand you have generate enough electricity for your whole property here.
Yeah, so that sustainability is just it's an easy thing to do. I mean, it's something that we can all kind of relate to. And we see solar panels everywhere, and we have great exposure to the western setting sun here. And when the original winery was built in 2005, solar was placed on it. And then we expanded the winery. We more than tripled our footprint of solar, and it's done a great job in helping offset our energy costs here. We also, work towards things that the wine industry can do better with regards to energy conservation is, skylights and tank rooms. So we barely use our electricity through lighting in our workspaces. And then also we have night air. So a lot of the wine industry has been doing this for years with HVAC, been using the cool nights. We all talk about the diverse temperature change here we have in wine country. And when it gets cold at night, we can bring in some of that cold air to cool our barrel rooms and not use energy. So little things like that that go a long way with regards to energy conservation.
And quite a few fermentation tanks, I understand. You ferment all the different lots separately?
Yes, everything. The big step towards understanding our vineyard was to retrofit the winery to match the work that we were doing 364 days in the field. I always say that one day a year, you don't want to put all the grapes into one pot. You want to be able to identify their ups and their downs, their challenges that you have from each parcel each year, but also the beauty and the perspective of each individual. As Ann said earlier, microclimates that we have on this site. So being able to expand a little bit and expand our footprint of fermentation tanks and our fermentation halls has been a true blessing for the winemaking team, and makes our lives a lot easier.
Well, Anne, we should certainly give a lot of credit to your parents, Cam and Kate, who kind of had the foresight to do what they've done here.
Yeah, my parents have worked incredibly hard and really followed through on a vision to kind of recreate Lark Mead as it was in the 20s as one of the best wineries in the valley and hopefully one of the best in the world, and have always emphasized quality and good relationships and teamwork and just worked untiringly, really, to bring this back into what it is today. And I think we're not done yet. We have so much more growth to do, and I'm looking forward to continuing their success. Yeah.
I want to briefly throw out, too, I'm a bit of a history buff, and I love the old photos that you have that your family has collected and kept over the years that you can see on the website, including some of the awards you won in the Pan American Exposition back in the 30s.
Yeah, no, we're really lucky. I mean, this is a historic estate. It was originally developed by the Salmina family, and Lily Hitchcock Coit's family was here, and, there's been, my family's been here since 48. So yeah, we have a lot of our family has a lot of history here, and yet it's
a storied place.
Yeah, it is.
Lily Hitchcock herself is enough for one story alone.
High character gal, yeah. We could all be so colorful. We should probably have more parties like she did. But we try to take inspiration from her, really. We hold our salon events, where we try and bring people together to talk about the issues of the day. We've been doing some on climate change and the future of Cabernet, and that was really inspired by her life. She would bring Bret Hart and Joaquin Miller and Robert Louis Stevenson and kind of all the writers of the day out to her place. And so, I think kind of, between my mom's gallery, art and culture and cultivating the wine kind of all goes together,
Well, I've really enjoyed learning about the place over the last few days, and look forward to coming back with my wife so we can actually experience it the way it's supposed to be.
Cool.
I'm getting a little piece of it right now. But
great.
Thanks, Anne, for your time. And Dan, appreciate it.
Yeah,
nice talking
so
with you.
Thank you so much for coming to talk with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Anne Baker, the daughter of Lark Mead owner Cam Baker and Kate Solari Baker, and winemaker Dan Petroski. Their website is full of interesting content about the history of Lark Mead, including some eyebrow-raising details of the bourbon-swilling, cigar-smoking, poker-playing Lily Hitchcock of the original family on the property. Visit larkmead.com. I can't say enough nice things about Kim, Dan, and the entire staff at Lark Mead. They were very accommodating. Up next, we'll travel over the mountain to Sebastopol and visit with Ted Lemon of Literai as On the Wine Road continues. We're back on the Wine Road. I'm Jeff Davis.
Today's topic, slow wine. It's a movement that follows the same principles as the slow food movement, farming with sustainable practices, and winemaking as well. This is part two of my celebration of Earth Day, which is coming up on Monday. Each year, Slow Wine issues a guide, which is like a book, of the hundreds of Italian, California, and now Oregon wineries who fit the criteria of the slow wine movement. Lark Mead Estate was one, and so is Litteri Wines. Ted Lemon is the winemaker and owner, and you may not be familiar with his brand, but his reputation precedes him. Even Dan at Lark Mead spoke highly of Ted. Now, when I visited Lark Mead, you could hear the birds chirping in the background. In Sebastopol, it was a light, rainy day when Ted and I met 2 weeks ago, and what I didn't notice at the time was the dripping of his downspout as we sat on the patio outside his office. So that's what you'll hear this time in the background. It was a comfortable day otherwise, and the rain led to my first question.
On my way over today with this rain that seems to keep persisting week after week, I was going to ask you, since you are the farmer, is there a point where it's just too much rain, or are you still okay with it so far?
I guess that answer to that is partly the question, the human question of, you know, whenever there are floods, that's too much from a human damage and consequence point of view. There's no question about that, so I wouldn't want to make light of it. But it's a blessed inconvenience is the way I would describe it, right? We feel lucky to have it. If it's interrupting work, well, so be it. That's just the way it is. I mean, you see today with the crews out, it's raining, but we're plugging along on stuff that can be done. So we're happy to have it.
Sure adds to the beauty. I can see a lot of colorful flowers out there already.
Yes, so it's a great time for us. As you said, there's the wildflowers have just begun, right, in some of the vineyard rows, but a lot of the stuff around on the edges growing. You and I are looking at Ceanothus, which is a California native, which is the dark purple one. Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful. That one's called Dark Star, for those of you who are Grateful Dead fans. But there's all these beautiful, beautiful plants that are native here that, you know, we've discovered too over the years of working here and planting them as companions. It's been incredible.
When you started this project of the farming, was it just to have a farm? Were you thinking grape growing initially, or did that come a little bit later?
Yeah, no, I'm a lifelong winemaker, so we bought this property with the intention of planting it. But as I mentioned, when you and I were walking around, it was really that intention of making a wine farm, something that is not just pure vineyard, something that has a real sense of ecological balance and health and all that stuff. That's why on 30 acres, there's only three planted.
I read that your farm is modeled after Rudolf Steiner's vision of an integrated farm. Is that what you were kind of fashioned this after?
No, that's right. So he's the father of biodynamic farming, and you'll see this. Now, it's very interesting. It's spreading throughout the organic and alternative farming community. They'll start to use this language much more now of the self-sustaining farm or the farm individuality or what other. And that's really what it's all about, trying to create a sense of place, and with that sense of place should come that environmental and ecological balance, so that whatever you need to do in the vineyard is as little as possible, right? You're not spraying insecticides, you've got a natural rhythm, the vines have a natural health that helps them resist everything, because in all living things, the question is never, is disease present, right? Disease is present in all living things. The question is, does it express itself? And so if you can keep a plant or a human healthy so that disease does not express itself, then you're a happy person.
You mentioned it's as little work as possible, but you certainly put in a lot of work around here. That the compost piles that you have are massive.
Yeah, I mean, it's not to say that there isn't work, but all of that is sort of, I hope, the background work where you create healthy soils through your own compost. And so, again, you don't have to do more.
Your vineyards are biodynamic, Pivot Vineyard in Haven, but you also source from other vineyards, and those are also organic at the very least, right?
Yeah, so just to be very clear, nothing at Litteri is certified. That's a philosophical question for me. But everything that we farm and own ourselves, and in fact 85% of production is farmed using biodynamic methods, and then 15% is non-certified practicing organic.
Talking about additives being unnecessary, focusing on hands-on farming, and is that how your winemaking is as well?
Yeah, I think you would know better than I, having interviewed lots of winemakers, but every winemaker will, of course, say that. But I do think getting it is admirable and appropriate to bring in fruit that is in such health and condition that you can do as little as possible. There, in my mind, there is no such thing as natural winemaking. It's a human undertaking. So all the choices involve humans. And to some extent, using the term natural winemaking is disrespectful for the many, many generations who labored so hard. I mean, if a Litterai or any of our friends or a Chateau Montelena in Napa is doing well, it's not because we're so darn smart. It's because we are literally the top of a pyramid of many generations who never made a dollar, who worked really hard, who barely survived, who perfected Pinot Noir, Cabernet, the way we make it, the regions we grow it in. So it's not that we're so smart. We're just more lucky, I think, to be where we are when we are.
I think a lot of it has to do with the vineyards itself. I mean, some certainly provide much better grapes that make an awesome wine, and some places it's a little more challenging.
For sure, and I don't mean to minimize that. You're absolutely right. I mean, it's all about that real estate and what's the exposure, what's the drainage, is the right material planted there, right? It can be a great vineyard, but if you have the wrong clone or the wrong variety, it's not going to work. So you're absolutely right.
But you're better off if you don't have to do a whole lot in the winery. And I like that French term. The hardest thing to do is nothing at all.
Yeah, to do nothing. Absolutely. And that's true, especially when you're young in your career. You want to do something. You've gone to enology school. You've learned all these things. And it's like, oh, no, something's a little off. It's not quite normal. I want to go do X, Y, and Z. And I think experience helps, don't you, with that? I mean, I think it's true in all professions. Experience helps to guide you to be not so reactive and to recognize that the natural course of a fermentation or of aging is going to be individual every time.
I was glad I got the invitation to go to the slow wine event back in early March, and it opened my eyes to a lot of things. And I'd heard about the slow food movement, but did not know it was getting into the wine industry. And I understand that you've been chosen as a California winery since they first welcomed California wineries into their slow wine guide.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact details, but they came to see us as they were thinking about expanding both the guide beyond Italy and looking at the States. And we just felt it was important to support the movement because it is a great way to expose things like the Gravenstein apple to a wider audience of people who might not be aware of its status, the fact that there's not a lot of Graves left, etc. And, of course, applied to any number of foods or crops. And it really felt like, regardless of whether it brought anything to Litterai in terms of visitors or consumers, it was important to support it. Yeah.
I couldn't imagine you saying, no, I don't want to be a part of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of who we are, right? Yeah. I mean, that's in the DNA for sure.
You're a perfect example of what they're trying to propose and cover. And it's amazing the amount of wineries that are in the current book, the 2019. They do a lot of research.
They do, and I think they've been very, they've really enjoyed working in the States. I can't speak for them, but my sense from the outside is that that opportunity to discover new world wines, to see in a lot of cases that it is not this vast monoculture, right? I mean, in Oregon or the Sonoma Coast, you've got smaller vineyards, forests around them. If I can say so, it's a healthier farming landscape, perhaps than some of the classic regions where you have, a lot more concentrated acreage. So I think they've enjoyed it.
Are you finding a growing number of people are seeking wines made in the slow wine, sustainable farming method?
You know, I think they find us for sure. I think one of the most interesting things to me is that a lot of our ideas and what we do, obviously, is not it's not traditional Western agronomy. And you might think that a lot of people would look at these ideas and say that they're all crazy. But I think there's an openness amongst people to seeking out different ways of farming, whether it's organic or permaculture or whatever. And so we do find that people really, really enjoy it and they really respond to it.
I should congratulate you on your 2014 Haven Vineyard Pinot Noir. That was the one that picked up the Great Wine Award from the Slow Wine Guide.
Right. Actually, we just tasted that wine the other day. Yeah, that was the first property that we purchased and planted, and it was biodynamic from the beginning. So one of the things we did, for instance, we all, as property owners, want to go out and fence every corner of our property, right? Whether you're suburban or urban or, you know, anything else. And we said, no, we're only going to fence the vineyard, right? The other 5 acres of this property, that's for the wild creatures. And so starting down that path felt really good to me.
So you let the deer roam and whatever else might be wandering through.
Right. It's only the vineyard is fenced out for them. They have the rest of the property.
Tell me about the your other vineyards that you that are part of the estate and the ones you source from.
Sure. So as we mentioned, we're sitting at the Pivot Vineyard where the winery is located, 3 acres of Pinot Noir. The Haven is owned by us. We have a property in Anderson Valley, which is 1,600 feet above Boonville, which is 8.5 acres. Tyriot Vineyard, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay on Taylor Lane in Occidental are long-term leases. Roman Vineyard in Anderson Valley is a long-term lease. And then the others are mostly long-term purchase contracts.
You enjoy that cool climate and ocean influence, don't you?
Yeah, the financial part's sometimes less rewarding, but that's part of the gig. Right, I mean, we figure when we make our projections as a winery, we say, look, if we can do 2 tons per acre over 10 years on average, that's pretty good. Just because, as you know, closer to the coast, more rain, fog hangs around longer, you're just going to get lower yields. It's part of the game.
And did I see you're growing or bottling Chenin Blanc, too?
We do. We have the only Chenin Blanc out on the Sonoma coast. It's a little tiny half acre of quite dense clay. I didn't think it was appropriate for Pinot and Chardonnay, so I've always loved Chenin, and I thought it'd be a fun thing to do, and we've really enjoyed doing it. It's a lot of fun.
I didn't get a chance to try his Chenin Blanc, but he did take me through a few of his Pinot Noir vineyard designates, and they were very nice. A good balance of fruit and acidity. It's a delicious example of cool climate wines. I liked Ted's response when I asked, is he making any new plans, or has he dialed it in?
I don't think anybody ever dials it in. We're at about 5,000 to 7,000 cases. Great size for us. We're not going to grow, that's for sure. We'll become more and more estate over time, but slowly, because that's expensive, etc. Vine age is a big deal. So having older vines now is really helpful for us. Mm-hmm. The support of our crew. You know, I don't know if we mentioned this, but we're a bootstrap winery. There was no family fortune behind Litteri, and there are no investors. So it's very part of what we see as progress is the human sustainability by that. And what I mean by that is we've always been very lean and mean, right? But several years ago, we added health insurance for not only the employees, but all their families. So the whole families are covered. Then we added a retirement plan with a match from the company. So that kind of driving forward is also really important to me, that we continue to make sure, and you know this as well as I do, that people can afford to live in Sonoma County, which is a challenge, that we're supporting people in the right way, especially in the vineyard crew. That feels really, really important to me. There are no, you know, the full-time crew is full-time all year, right? We keep them busy. We have projects for them. There's no 2 months without pay or anything like that. You know, if they're full-time, it's for sure and for real. And that's really important to both my wife, Heidi, and I. So pushing forward on that matters.
And that security, knowing that your crew is going to be here, is also important these days.
It's huge, right? You bet. I mean, there's no bigger issue in farming than labor, no question.
And keeping your employees happy and being concerned about them is part of the sustainable structure.
Mm-hmm. And also, you know, what's unfortunate in Western culture is we've gotten to this point where we sort of devalue physical labor. And, you know, not everybody is cut out to be the CEO of a major corporation or to be a math genius PhD. And we enjoy the physical labor we all do at Litteri. And I'm not saying that everybody wants to be outside every day, but if the conditions are right and there's a diversity of work and you're not spending, you know, 8 hours a day for 3 weeks doing the same damn job, if you alternate jobs, our crew is really skilled, and they need to be paid that way because they can prune a vineyard, they can replant a vineyard, they can go out and, you know, prune companion plantings, they can build a compost pile, they can move the sheep. I mean, this is skilled labor, and it's important that they are treated that way, and that we make sure that there's a diversity of things to keep everybody interested. And I'm sorry that in the States we belittle physical labor, because I think we'd be a much healthier society if all of us had to get out and sweat,
yeah,
you know, and have a shovel every now and then. It's a way of being in contact with the earth and being part of nature. It's important.
I'll tell you, I enjoy working in the studio, but some of my most enjoyable times doing this show is getting out and helping out with the harvest.
Sure, you bet. There's that excitement. There's the physical labor. I mean, I think we all feel that.
One thing we haven't talked about yet, tell me about your animals that you have on the farm and what their responsibilities
are.
Sure.
So we're wine people, of course. We started with ducks and chickens because we wanted to go slow. Boy, I don't know when this is. This is probably the early 2000s now when we started. And getting them out in the vineyards. And then we moved to sheep several years later. And then finally to cows, so about 35 sheep, which graze the vineyards. The cows, not so much the vineyards, they're more the open fields, etc. But it's really, the value of the sheep in the vineyard is really incredible. You get greater species diversity. Of course, you get the fertilizer from the sheep manure. There's the fact, well, we're sitting in it. We're a wet spring. Instead of having to drive a heavy tractor out there to mow, the sheep do the work. There's no compaction. So there's all these little benefits to it. But it really is funny, the first couple of years, Jeff, when we were not animal people learning how to work with animals, it should have been on YouTube comedy show or something. It was pretty funny.
Did I see you have bees on the property too?
We do. We used to do honeybees, and we let those go back to nature because we didn't like the hive thing, and we didn't really want to collect the honey with honeybees under attack. So we do only native bees now, so non-honey producing native bees, which we have learned how to encourage through hives, etc. It's called osmias. Well, both osmias and leafcutter bees. And so each vineyard has three or four of these, I wouldn't call them hives, but homes where these solitary nesting bees can set up shop.
They're still doing their job pollinating them.
They are among the most efficient pollinators in the world. They're incredible. They're small black bees. I encourage anyone in your audience to look them up. They can easily have them in their home. You can get these little starter kits, and they have no interest in us. They'll buzz in and out. They don't sting. And they have very short lifespans, but they are very systematic in the way they pollinate crops.
I didn't know you could adopt them like that.
Yeah, they're very simple. They cannot make their own holes, so they need a carpenter bee, or a termite, or ants, or someone to have made a hole in dead wood. And they rely on that. But once you set up and encourage them, they just do their own thing. They're quite extraordinary. They no pollen pockets. They're covered with hair, and so they're incredibly efficient pollinators because they're just bathing in it. It's a bacchanalian fest, if I could say that.
Right.
Yeah, right.
As a winemaking man, that's a good term, yeah. Well, I admire what you're doing here, and I know you have great respect in the industry, so keep up the good work.
Thanks. Thanks for coming to see us.
What a great guy. And you can tell Ted's lifestyle suits him well. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to meet his wife and partner, Heidi. You can find quite a bit of information about the farm, the wine, and the family at littorai.com, littorai.com. And learn more about the slow wine movement at slowwineusa.com. They're also on Facebook under Slow Wine and Slow Wine Guide. I hope you've been inspired these last 2 weeks listening about sustainable practices here on the Wine Road. Let's all put a little more effort into treating the earth thoughtfully. It's the only home we have. Find more interviews on my website, onthewineroad.com, and as a podcast, On the Wine Road Podcast. I'm also on Facebook. Thanks for joining me again on the Wine Road. I'm Jeff Davis.